Accession number 27075, Reel 33.
Yes, the
AOC said, well, the possibility, we've got to face the possibility of the Mediterranean being closed. Therefore, we've got to have a route from South Africa or possibly from the Sudan for reinforcing the canal zone with short-range jet fighter aircraft. And therefore, we've got to know something about a possible route. And therefore, I want you and some others, the wing commander coming down from Air Ministry, and one or two other specialists, to climb into a Valletta and fly down to Pretoria. And on the way down, have a look at all sorts of airfields, get as much information you can about these airfields, facilities, and so on. Find out about weather conditions, everything we might need to know about reinforcing the canal zone from South Africa. So off we all poodled, and we flew off from Shalufa. Was it fine, I think. Flew down to Wadi Halfa, Khartoum, and then southwards, landing at a dozen different airfields, spending a night at each one, getting all the information we could together, and so on, down to Pretoria, had a nice party in the mess there with the South African Air Force, and then back by a slightly different route, taking in airfields that we'd not seen on the way out, and back to the canal zone, back to Shalufa.
What would these airfields have to have?
First of all, of course, runway of a sufficient length for takeoff and landing. They'd have to have refueling facilities acceptable to jet aircraft. That's to say, they'd have to have the kerosene that we used. We'd need to have met information. And ideally, homing information, bearing in mind the Vampire has only got VHF radio, we have no other navigational aids. And therefore, it may be necessary to take lead aircraft, mosquito lead aircraft, or the filters that we used, the Homer that we used on the Turkish tour, although it wasn't essential. So we got back and weighed it all up. I wrote out my report and gave a list of the airfields that it seemed to me were suitable, the right distances for the range, bearing in mind we'd be flying Vampires or similar, which could or could not be fitted with long-range fuel tanks. So I did my report and took it to the AOC, and he read it and said, right, said, quite happy with all this, are you? I said, yes, eh? Yeah. He asked me a few questions. I said, right, you better go and do it, hadn't you? I said, yes, sir. What sort of four should we have? Well, they said, I think four Vampires. We better have a mosquito to get you through the intertropical convergency zone, which is the belt of really bad weather across the middle of Africa. And the letters to take your ground crews and whatever spares, etc., equipment you might need on the flight. And he said, I want it to coincide with the official opening of Entebbe Airport, which will be opened by the Buganda of Uganda, their king. And I'd like you to visit one or two other people while you're on the way down. And we had a fortnight to get everything ready. And so we did it. And well, this was to be the proving flight of jet fighter aircraft on the reinforcement route from South Africa to the Suez Canal zone. The force would comprise four vampires, two mosquitoes, five letter aircraft. Total distance to be flown would be 7,213 nautical miles. Each leg of the route would be up to 2 hours. Some of the legs were an hour 20, an hour 50. We had one at we had two at 200, 2 hours. One at 2 hours 5 minutes. One at 2 hours 15 minutes. That was the leg from Khartoum to Juba. And the route went Shalufa to Wadi Halfa, Khartoum, Juba. Entebbe, where we did the official opening of the Entebbe International Airport, where the Israelis later on were to do their big stunt. Tabora in Tanganyika, Kasama, Lusaka in northern Rhodesia, Livingston, Schwartkop, which was the South African Air Force base of Pretoria, and then returning via Belvedere, which was Salisbury, Ndola, Tabora. We're coming back now across Tanganyika to Eastleigh, in which is Nairobi, Kenya, Juba, Khartoum, Wadi Halfa, and back home. Total of 20 hours flying.
Did everything go without a hitch on that route?
Yes, it did. I think possibly there would have been a totally different way of doing it. Instead of Montgomery style, with large forces making absolutely certain that if anything did go wrong, it could soon be rectified on the spot. The alternative would have been to send a couple of vampires, perhaps, for company, and rely on the canal zone to come to our rescue if we were needed, wherever we might happen to be. It could have been done that way. It wouldn't have been nearly so much fun for the troops, because I forget how many I did take with me in the end. I think it probably worked it up to about 30, 20 or 30 anyway, who all climbed into the Valletta and had a whale of a jolly good time seeing parts of the world they'd never have a chance seeing again. And so it was decided that we'd take the big force and make a real splash. Also, did a bit of flag waving while we were down there. The aerobatic team would do their stuff, particularly at Entebbe, when the whole population were going to turn out to open the airport. And so, yes, it all went off swimmingly. We got back on time. There were no major hold-ups. Something did get forgotten on one of the aircraft. Somebody had to go back for something, but it wasn't vital. It didn't cause any real problems. The only real problem, as far as I was concerned, was my engine had a nasty habit of fading out when I least wanted it to. Well, when this happens, it was usually caused by forget the name of the component. Anyway, whatever it was called, it could pack up, or half pack up, and the effect would be that there'd be a sudden drop in engine power. And this happened on the second day. On the first day, in fact. Yeah, on the first day, going into Khartoum, we'd refueled at Wadi Halfa and went on down to Khartoum, and my engine began to fade on final approach. I wanted a bit more power to get me over the airfield is right on the edge of the Nile, and I needed a bit more power to get me across the Nile onto the runway. And I opened up the throttle, and there was no extra power there. The engine was running, but nothing like full power. And I tell a little story about the last few feet approaching the end of the runway, still over the Nile, and looking down, I could see crocodiles with their jaws wide open, waiting for me to plop in. However, the aircraft made the runway, but that did happen on two or three other occasions. In fact, whatever this component, the name of which I forget, whatever it was replaced on two occasions. And coming home on the very last leg, Wadi Halfa, exactly the same thing happened again, but this time after takeoff. However, we'd gained height by then, and I decided to take a chance and see if I could get home, and in fact I did, and everybody got home happily. And it was, to say the least of it, an interesting trip. We saw all sorts of parts of the world we'd never like to visit again, particularly at Livingstone, where we went to see the Victoria Falls, which is something I say everybody in this world should see sometime in their lifetime, particularly as it was on this occasion. And it was in full spate, and there were millions of tons of water coming over. And my flight commander, a former Boscombe Down test pilot by the name of Pinky Stark, one of my flight commanders, and Lancashire lad, and we stood gazing at this incredible spectacle, masses of water, tons and tons and tons of it, all this spray pluming up and making an artificial rain in this rainforest. And we stood listening and watching this incredible sound, and Pinky said, "Oh, pardon my accent, said I, remarkable, but I'm darned if I can see anything to stop it." And that indeed was the way it was. So it was a good trip, and it was my last trip with 32 Squadron, because when I got home on the 26th of November, I was greeted with the news that I was going to the Staff College, and I was to start packing immediately, including packing up the married quarter, handing it over, getting the family all ready to go home, etc., etc., etc.
Could I just ask a couple of things about, obviously, the time that you were in the Canal Zone? What were you flying in? What kit were you wearing when you were flying in the Vampire?
Oh, always a flying suit. Oddly enough, all the time I was in Malta and the desert, I seldom wore, except in the winter when it was cold, put blue uniform on, but during the summer months, I nearly always wore shortened shirts. Most people wore flying suits of some sort, largely as a protection against fire, although it seemed to me that you sat sweating in this thing, and if the aeroplane was going to go on fire, a little thin bit of a flying suit clothing wasn't going to protect you very much. If it was made of asbestos, that might be a different matter, but I couldn't see that cotton was going to help that. So I never bothered to buy a flying suit. But when I joined, when I was at Fighter Command, I got myself a suit there. It was the standard blue flying suit with all the zip-up pockets everywhere. And this, the purpose farewell.
Did you wear a helmet then?
Oh, yes, war flying helmet. A lightweight one, in fact. We didn't wear the leather ones in the desert. Now, I've got some pictures somewhere, which I can't.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is about, obviously, there's the political situation in the Canal Zone wasn't good during the period you were there.
No, and it got steadily worse. And, in fact, I think it was a week or two before I was due to depart, there was a very severe trouble in Suez. Well, Shalufa was about 20 miles up the road along the canal from Suez town, and we had living in the town a lot of families, and they were told when the political situation became somewhat strained, the families were told not to expose themselves out in the streets too much, to stay in their quarters, although one realizes that you've got to take kids out from time to time. But there was the possibility that incidents might occur, and there was a story, I never discovered whether it was true or not, that up at a town in the middle of a canal zone, I've forgotten the name of it, where there are a large number of families, Army and Air Force families, and the mob was they were all living in a compound, and the mob was said to be on its way to attack this compound, but as it happened, a detachment of infantry soldiers happened to be nearby at the time, and they rushed them round to this scene. And the story meant they only just got there in time and headed this mob off. So that sort of thing could happen. And about a week before we were due to go, I was in the mess, and the station commander came rushing in and said, I want you to take 25 chaps with guns, with rifles, Sten guns, to Suez and get the families out. He said the families are to be given half an hour, no more, to get themselves together, get in their trucks and be away. The husbands are to go with you. They're not to have any nonsense from anybody. They're to do exactly what they're told. The trucks will be positioned at a certain point. The police will be there, surrounding the trucks. The husbands are to bring the families and as much as they can carry and get in the trucks and be away with half an hour. And by the time we were down there, it was about midnight, I think. The whole place was very quiet. But we got to the point, and the police were there with their great big long canes that would be huge, great, long anti-mob sticks they used to carry. And we got down there, and the husbands all went dashing off in all directions. And about 10, 15, 20 minutes later, they all started coming along the road, kids crying. It was quite pathetic. Anyway, we got them all into the trucks. And as we were departing, we could see down the streets there were people beginning to get together. But the last of the husbands came along with his family and hopped in, and off we went. Well, Shalufa was completely surrounded by wire, and we turned out the reinforcement guards until things are all quietened down. And fortunately, there was a sufficient vacant accommodation in the Shalufa compound for these families. Makeshift as it was, they were in the Nafi and all sorts of places, but we could at least accommodate them under shelter. And aircraft were laid on, they were flown home within 2 or 3 days.
Prior to that incident, would you have taken precautions if you'd have gone into Suez?
I had a stain gun on my lap. I'd never fired one I had fired one, but it was a nasty, silly little thing. If it had come to it, we'd have had to have a battle.
How did the trouble usually manifest itself with the Egyptians? How did the trouble usually manifest itself with the Egyptians?
Oh, just mobs. All this business. Yeah, you know. I don't think we ever saw any weapons, not on display anyway. But the fact was, there was little direct contact between the British families and the local populace. The only contact would be on the basis of where you had to deal with them, you did. But as is nearly always the case with overseas families, they tend to live among themselves, but by themselves in their own little setups. And that is true today. There are families all over the Middle East living in compounds.
So you left and you returned to the UK to go to Staff College?
Did the year at Bracknell, yes. Bracknell Staff College was a jolly good year. Did all sorts of things. A lot of lecturing by all sorts of most interesting people, including people like Penny, the atomic bomb man, Montgomery, all sorts of admirals and generals and air marshals, all sorts. And very interesting it was. It was very well organized. We were divided up into groups of half a dozen with our own wing commander directing staff, one of whom was Christopher Foxton Norris, who died soon last year, became president of the Battle of Britain Association. He was my wing commander, director for a period. And we went on hordes of visits all over the place. We went to practically a representative of every type of unit you could imagine, all sorts of infantry units, artillery units. We went to Lark Hill artillery ranges and were shelled, shells whizzing over our heads. That was great. A great tank battle was fought out. We were up on a hilltop, and this tank battle was fought out down below for us. And we went to Greenwich to see the Navy. We went to Plymouth to see warships of various sorts. We went up to Londonderry. We went to see a destroyer having an exercise with a submarine. That was interesting. All sorts of things like that. It was a very, very good year. Everything was packed into it. Very little of it was of any direct use. The courses are like this. But there is always something you can pluck out and say, well, that really was most useful. I wouldn't have missed that for the world. Now I've got cramp in my left leg, so I have to stand up.
What was the syllabus like?
It was very comprehensive. It had two basic objectives, I think. One was to enable us to think, and the other was to enable us to write. And so we had written exercises. We each had a cubbyhole in the box on the wall. And every morning we'd go and pull out our papers for the day. and there'd be different colours. A pink meant you had to weigh up a particular situation and do a praise or an appreciation of it. And you were given so many hours or days to complete this particular exercise. Some of them were just brief, you had to put them in the same morning. Others you could have overnight and so on. And then the next day, you go to your box and take out the day's work, and there would be the wing commander's consideration of how you dealt with a particular problem. And the year went on like that. It passed very quickly, I must say.
Did you feel you got some staff ability from the work? Because you'd done quite a lot of admin work as well, hadn't you?
Yes, I had done that admin work, and I'd had the 3 years at Fire Command behind a desk. So, yeah, that was all very helpful. I don't know that, that my solutions are any better. I think it's unlikely.
Was it a good opportunity to meet, obviously, people again within the Air Force or get in touch again with people you've known?
Yes.
Throughout your
Yes, there were there were half a dozen people there that I knew quite well. One or two others I'd come across before. Yeah. And of course, later on, you'd bump up with some of the other people who'd been on the course, people I'd not known before, but got to know very well during the year on the course. And consequently, from the Staff College, I was posted to the Air Ministry, and within the Air Ministry, of course, there were quite a few people I knew from one place or another, including from the Staff College. So that did happen.
Were you expecting that kind of a posting after you'd finished the course, or did you think that you might? You thought you might have gone back to an operation?
I thought it was likely, since I just had 3 years commanding an operational squadron. I thought it'd be more than likely that I'd be given another staff job. And the Air Ministry was okay. In fact, it was another world, or at least another totally different way of life. One found some accommodation wherever, made an arrangement with the owners to take the place on a furnished basis, and then hand the whole thing over to the admin people at the unit, Air Ministry unit headquarters, where all the admin work was done, hand the job over to them, and they'd tie up all the letting with the owners and pay the bills and so on.
So where did you get accommodation?
And I got accommodation in Berylands, which is just near, Berylands, near Surbiton. I used to get the train from Berylands station every morning, across Waterloo Bridge, and I was in the Director General of Organisations Department in Kingsway.
Would you have worn your uniform when you were commuting?
No, we were in civilian clothes in the Air Ministry. Unless we were going on a visit, so we'd quite frequently go on visits. Organisation department, of course, was closely concerned with airfields and amenities generally. So we'd go and visit these places, and there'd be a site conference held. If, say, an airfield was due to change commands, something might go from bomber to fighter command or coastal command. So we'd have a site conference and sort it all out. So quite a lot of visiting, and on those visits we'd go in, we'd wear uniform. And indeed, if one was going flying, and again we had access to aircraft which were kept at Hendon, but they had only got Ansons and Chipmunks and things like that at Hendon, because it wasn't big enough for the jets. But it was